Melusine by Toft Froggy. Read by Things with Wings. Listen to me. I will tell you a story. This is the story. A young woman called Shirth walked in the woods, not far from the home of her mother's and father's. Under a tree she saw a horloth, tall and handsome, with eyes like the twin moons reflected on water. It whispered to her, "Listen to me. I will tell you a story. This is the story. A young woman called Shirth walked in the woods." The room erupts into laughter. The queen smiles shortly. "A proper story, if you please, Curla. Something our guests will enjoy." The long-haired guy inclines his head, a weird little smile on his face that Rodney doesn't quite like. "As I said, a young woman called Shirth walked in the woods not far from the home of her mother's and father's. Under a tree she saw a horloth, tall and handsome, with eyes like the pools of the ancestors' rings. It whispered to her, 'Come lie with me. Your children will grow strong and wise, stand tall, and make the ancestors proud.' Shirth said to the horloth, 'I was told your kind only spoke to the beautiful. I am not beautiful.' Then the horloth gave her a necklace, and the jewel of the necklace glowed green as the fourth moon, and he said, 'You are beautiful to me.'" Rodney pokes John in the side. "Seriously," he whispers, "if we have to sit through this all night." Taylor glares, and Rodney snaps his mouth shut, then casually scratches his jaw with his middle finger in John's direction. John smirks, but it looks fake, like he's trying too hard. "Oh, sorry," Rodney hisses, suddenly losing his temper. "Am I compromising your judgment again?" John's back straightens and his jaw goes tight, and he looks pointedly towards the center of the room, ignoring Rodney. Rodney fumes in silence. The horloth sang the song of joining, and Shirth lay with him and conceived a child. She went back to her people, and when her child was born, her people said, "This child is not of our blood." And Shirth was cast out. Rodney doesn't even know why the hell they're here. It's like a fairy tale, it's so ridiculous. It goes like this. Once upon a time, he, John, Taylor, and Ronan stepped through the gate into a field of luminescent white flowers, glowing in the evening shadows like a thousand little stars. Up ahead of them, there's a castle. "Looks occupied," says John. "This what you were looking for?" "It is as I remember," Taylor says, striding across the field of flowers without even looking at them. "These people always had a great many contacts with traders on other worlds. They may have word of my people." "Let's just go carefully, okay?" John says, and they follow Taylor through the flowers. The glowy pollen makes Rodney sneeze, and, weirdly, Ronan. Ronan blows his nose into the grass with two fingers. "That's really disgusting," Rodney says. "You carry it around in your pocket," says Ronan, and he sneezes again. At the castle gate, there's a woman waiting for them, dressed all in white, with a red scarf covering her hair. She holds her arms out, palms cupped towards the sky, and she says, "Strangers, I beg your hands and your weapons against what ails us." John glances at Taylor, Rodney, and Ronan. Taylor steps forward and places her hands in the woman's. "We give our hands and our weapons," she says solemnly, and Rodney realizes it's a formula, like a promise. "Tell us your troubles, and let us tell you ours." The woman ushers them in through the gate, or rather, through the little door set in the giant gate, which looks like it hasn't been opened for a couple of hundred years. Rodney scrutinizes it as she hurries them through, but the night's coming in fast now, and he can't tell if it's made of wood or stone. The castle itself is the kind of quasi-medieval military base they've seen a few times now on various worlds. Thick stone defenses with extensive tunnel networks. as settlements, they have their pros and cons. They're huge targets for culling, but it's kind of hard to sneak up on them. And although wraith beams work through thin wooden ceilings or tent fabric, they can't penetrate 5 feet of stone or earth. Given enough food and clean water, these castles are about as secure as they come. Usually. It began several months ago, the woman says, ushering them into a low-ceilinged room, and she waves her hands to quiet the hubbub of noise that rises up when they enter. There are about 40 people sitting in the room at a long table, most of them with plates of food in front of them. There's an air of tension in the room that even Rodney notices, especially when a couple of the guys leap up and pull out knives. The queen waves at them to sit down. The pollen of the night suns is our most valued commodity, and it can only be collected in the evening. We collect it and preserve it, then trade it for food. But recently something has been attacking my people outside the castle. Many have died, including my own husband. Our weapons are useless against it, and we cannot afford to wait any longer to collect the pollen. We have heard news of your power from other worlds. You've got a monster, Ronan says. You want us to kill it? The woman shows her teeth, but the smile doesn't reach her eyes. That would be nice. So they're given the lowdown on the monster. 12 feet tall, glowing eyes, stronger than 10 men, and faster than a wraith dart, etc., etc. Then they're given dinner. What is it with the Pegasus Galaxy and monsters? Rodney says around his first mouthful. I mean, why does this always happen to us? Everybody in the room glares at him, and Taylor says, "Shh!" In the middle of the room, a guy starts to tell the story. After walking for a day and a night with her child on her back, Shirth came to a red city. She fell down and slept by its walls, and in her dream, an ancestor spoke to her. He said, "What can you do to feed your child?" "I can hunt and kill Anakas to feed my people," she said. "I can hide my children from the wraith, and I can worship the ancestors in the way of times past." "They have no Lanakas in this city," the ancestors said. "They hide their own children, and they worship the ancestors in their own homes. But there has been a war here. Your breasts are dripping, and they have many orphaned infants. You may work as a nurse." And Shirth nursed infants for 3 years, until the milk dried up in her breasts. But because the babies had no mothers, she felt pain for them, and gave them more milk than to her own daughter, who grew slowly and small. When she had no more milk, there was no more work for her in the city, and Shirth went back to the Ring of the Ancestors and went through it.
"Jesus," John mutters.
Ronan elbows John in the side. "Is it time for the monster yet?" "This is an interesting variation on the story," Taylor murmurs. "In the version our singers used to tell at Midsummer, there were a great deal more talking animals." Rodney ignores them valiantly, and tries to work out whether the crest on the wall hanging is meant to be 2 birds or 3 elephants. "What do you think?" John mutters out of the corner of his mouth. Rodney starts to answer before he realizes that John's not talking to him, and shoves another spoonful of soup into his mouth instead. Ronan shrugs, keeping his voice low. "Should be easy. Our guns are better." The queen claps her hands, and suddenly the room opens out into a warm buzz of noise. "Interval," Ronan says, standing up. A man bends to listen to something the queen is saying, his long hair brushing hers as he looks up towards them and nods. He comes over to them with 2 others. "The sun is setting. The thing will be awake by now. Who will come?" "Me and Ronan," John says. "Rodney, check out those energy signatures. Taylor, ask them about your people and keep an eye on Rodney. Stay together and stay in contact, okay?" They go for a tour of the castle. Taylor pumps the queen for information without much success, by the sound of it, and Rodney watches his scanner. He's keeping an eye out for his chance, and when the queen pauses to show Taylor the impressive craftsmanship of an archway, Rodney goes on ahead a little and taps his radio. John? Yeah? How's it going? It's pretty quiet. Okay. Taylor's looking at architecture. Okay. I talked to Jeannie the other day. She's fine, totally recovered. Do you know she actually wants me to buy her a car? Rodney can still hear Taylor and the Queen talking quietly 20 feet behind him. He lowers his voice. He says, "Look, can you just be done freaking out soon? This whole thing is ridiculous." There's silence on the channel for a moment. Then John says, "Look, Rodney, this is kind of a bad time." Rodney stifles an impatient sigh and goes for more underhand tactics. "I really want to suck your cock." He can hear John take a deep breath and let it out, but he doesn't say anything, and he doesn't close the channel. Rodney closes his eyes and rubs the bridge of his nose. "Look, okay, sorry. Can we talk about this later? Gotta go," John says, and cuts the line. The story is just starting again when they walk in. Shirth walked for a day and a night, leading her daughter behind her, until she came to a black city. She fell down and slept by its walls, and the same ancestor appeared to her. "They do not eat meat in this city," the ancestor said. "They do not have time to hide from the wraith, and they have lost the faith of the ancestors. This city was destroyed. There is much to do, and your body is strong. You may work as a laborer." Shirth labored for 3 years, helping the people rebuild their city. Because they had lost all their children, she felt pain for them, and she allowed them to spoil her daughter. She gave all her strength to their buildings until she was bent over and tired and could no longer work and could earn no food for herself and her child. Then she went to the Ring of the Ancestors and walked for a day and a night. Their radios hiss, and Rodney shivers as John murmurs into his ear, "Rodney, Taylor, don't let anyone see you react to what I'm about to say, okay? We found the monster. He's unconscious right now." Rodney raises his eyebrows, but Taylor only shrugs. "He? We're going to talk to Atlantis before coming in, okay? Just sit tight." Taylor nods tersely at Rodney, and Rodney sits on his hands in frustration. The guy in the middle of the room hasn't stopped talking. On the second day, Shirth came to a blue city, where there were no children, and the walls and roofs were of metal and eternal. And she knew that it was the city of the ancestors. An ancestor came out of the gate and spoke to her. "You cannot support your child here. You must give her to us." Shirth said, "Would you take my daughter from me? She is my only child." And the ancestors said to Shirth, "With your body you have made babies grow strong, you have made buildings stand tall. Your children are scattered across many worlds, and we are proud." Then the ancestor took Shirth's necklace from her and placed it around her daughter's neck, and when the jewel touched her breast it glowed more fiercely than the 4 suns of Elion. And Shirth's daughter was frightened and tried to hide in her mother's skirts, but the green light surrounded her and it burned Shirth. Then the ancestor took Shirth's daughter, and the gates of Atlantis shut behind them. This is the end of the story. There's a pause, and then everyone sort of hums in applause. The storyteller bows. "Well, that was creepy," Rodney mutters, and Taylor nods incrementally. She seems about to say something, but then there's an uproar down in the corridor, and John and Ronan appear in the doorway, something slung between them. As they come out into the light, Rodney gets a good look at it. "Oh, shit," Rodney says. It's about 6 feet tall, humanoid, and it has blue scales crawling up its neck and around its face. Its nails are yellowed and sharpened into talons. It has long, stringy brown hair graying at its temples, and it's wearing a sort of cowl. For a terrible moment, Rodney thinks, for no reason at all, of Ford. Then he realizes that it's just that the monster looks like John did when he was infected with the retrovirus. Like what John became. "He did not scratch you?" Taylor says quickly, before Rodney can steel himself to ask the same question. John shakes his head, jaw tight. "Look," Ronan says, and nudges the guy's bound hand with his foot. Cutting into the finger, the scale swollen and oozing around it, is a gold ring. On the ring is the castle's crest, the same one from the wall hanging, the weird two-bird, three-elephant design. "I think you guys owe us an explanation," John says, eyes narrow. The queen's face is a white mask. The room is silent. "Tell them, Dar," says the storyteller harshly. "It's not fair." "Leave us," she says, and her people file out of the room, shooting looks at John, Rodney, Ronan, and Taylor, their gazes alighting the body on the floor. Only the guy, Curla, stays. The queen clears her throat. "That was my husband." She looks down at him, expressionless. "Is it dead?" "No," Ronan growls. "Stunned." The queen seems to deflate like a balloon, sways a little, and suddenly Curla is behind her, helping her into a chair. She pinches the bridge of her nose and takes a deep breath. Curla rubs her shoulder until she waves him off. Taylor, of course, is the first one to pull herself together. "When did he first begin to change?" she says. The queen laughs, a husky, sad little noise. "He went to one of the great fairs to negotiate a new price for our pollen harvest, and he was attacked at night for his money. When he tried to fight them off, one of the thieves bit him. The cut became infected, and he contracted this condition. It spread very slowly, and he kept it a secret. When we married..." Wait, what?" Rodney snaps. "When did this happen?" "We married 3 years ago," the queen says. "By that time, most of his left leg was... changed." "But that doesn't make any sense," Rodney says. "For the retrovirus to advance that slowly..." "Rodney," John growls. If Rodney didn't know him as well as he does, he'd never know anything was wrong. But John's just a shade too pale, and his mouth is a tight, thin line. He's not looking at the guy on the floor. When he catches Rodney looking at him, John twitches and takes a step out of reach. "You knew that he had this problem," Taylor says carefully, "and yet you married him?" Dar shrugs, elaborately casual in a way that reminds Rodney, weirdly, of John. "He was a good man and a good leader. He was so fast and strong, and the people felt safe with him. He was the best hunter we have ever had, and he shot down a wraith dart last time we were attacked. We agreed that when it became impossible to hide his illness, or when it overpowered him, I would help him to die in secret, so that he could be remembered well and I could remain queen. So, what happened?" "He hid the extent of his illness from me. He would have rages, then. I realize now that he was losing control of his impulses, but at the time I did not want to see it. He became violent, but he hid it from the people. Only I knew." She drew a deep breath. "It is not our custom to inquire into the dealings of a husband and wife." She stutters to a halt, then, and a tear slides down her face. She ignores it. Rodney looks at the table. He can practically feel John's stillness beside him. "We understand," Taylor says gently, and puts her hand over the queen's. John turns away abruptly and walks over to look out of the window. The line of his back, makes Rodney's throat ache. The queen clears her throat. Curla, you may explain this part. I saw his scales, the man says quickly, and spits on the floor close to the infected man's head, his face screwed up in dramatic disgust. Rodney takes an instant dislike to him. Earlier, when he was telling the story, all the gestures and the enunciating seemed normal, but in a regular conversation, it's weird and irritating. We were on a hunting trip. When he realized I had discovered his secret, he bolted, just like that. I swear, by the ancestors, you've never seen anyone move so fast. Really? Rodney mutters. Taylor frowns at Rodney, but Ronan cuts right through whatever the hell the guy is going to say next. You told the others he was killed by a monster. Well, yes, Curla says, looking annoyed that his flow has been interrupted. I have helped Dar keep her secret, and her power. He says power, like it's got a capital letter. Taylor's smiling polite daggers at him. John turns around, and it's like he's come back into the room. Your Majesty, could I talk to my team for a second? She nods, and silence follows the sound of the closing door. Do you think it's Beckett's retrovirus? Ronan says. Got to be, Rodney says, rubbing his eyes. Jesus, this is all they fucking need. She must have bitten someone else, that Wraith girl. What was her name? Aaliyah, Ronan says. Right, right. So maybe the virus has, I don't know, mutated or something, so that it doesn't kill the host immediately and has more time to be passed on. Or maybe it's been weakened. I don't know. I'm not a geneticist. We should take him back to Atlantis for Keller to... No! John snaps. I agree, Taylor says. Rodney, it is too dangerous. Just because the virus has progressed differently, it does not mean he will be any easier to control than in our prior experience. The risk of infection is too high. We could sedate him. You couldn't sedate me, John says. His voice is harsh, and Rodney winces. We didn't try to sedate you. That's not the point. Well, maybe you fucking should have, John snaps. Why are we even talking about this? Come on, Rodney. You know it's a bad idea, even if Woolsey goes for it. Oh, come on. Since when do you care what Woolsey goes for? We could cure him, Rodney yells, and suddenly he's furious and realizes he and John are right in each other's faces. We already did this. Beckett's research is in the computer. Keller could reverse the course of the virus, and this guy could live out his life. And hey, maybe we could even learn something from it. I know it's a departure for you, but do you think we could just this once maybe not kill someone because it's more convenient? Fuck you, John snarls. A little too late. Rodney's shaking. He's so angry. And it's come on so suddenly that he's dizzy with it. He can hardly breathe. Taylor lays a quiet but firm hand on Rodney's arm. Rodney, even if we could spare the military and medical resources to guard him and find a cure, do you really think he could resume his old life here? Do you think his people would take him back? His wife? Rodney can't really think of an answer to that. 3-1 we kill him, Ronan says, and slings his blaster over his shoulder. It's the right thing to do. On the floor, the bug king, Arlath, twitches and opens his eyes, and John shoots him in the head. Grayish, semi-translucent goo and blood and green stuff explodes over the floor. Arlath's legs jerk, then John shoots him again, and there's a hole where most of Arlath's jaw was. One yellow, bloody eye falls open and stays open. Oh, Jesus, Rodney mutters, his gorge rising. John's face is totally white, and he has spatters of dark stuff on his hand, on his pants, and his chin. Ronan puts a hand on his shoulder and sort of shakes him a little, tugs him back from the body, and John wobbles like a rag doll. Rodney looks away. Taylor opens the door, and the queen steps in. She looks at the body on the ground, expressionless. Thank you, she says finally. She rubs at her eyebrow, then the back of her neck. Then she clears her throat and stands up a little straighter to look John, then Taylor in the eye. Lantians, we would be most honored if you would witness the combat for the kingship. Curla will fight Ralan, my second cousin, to the death. Great, John says, and even Taylor winces at his smile. No problem. It takes another 2 hours for them to set up the ring of combat and get Curla and another shorter, stupid-looking guy to sign a whole load of forms, and they have to chant some kind of oath together in front of a woman in a red hat. This is barbaric, Rodney hisses. Seriously? Combat? It is quite normal, Rodney, Taylor says quietly. I won the leadership of my people through combat. Rodney blinks, arrested. What? Seriously? But you... Did you kill anyone? Of course, Taylor says. Such fights are always to the death, or the leader's authority could never be strong. I killed Holling's nephew, Japheth. He stares at her. Is that why Holling... I always assumed they elected you, or something. They did, she says calmly. Japheth challenged me, nonetheless. She meets Rodney's eyes with a calm, steady stare. I cut his throat. He was 19 years old. I regret it, but it was necessary. Oh, says Rodney. He swallows. Well. He looks back at the circle they're drawing on the floor of the hall. John is over the other side of it, talking with the queen, their heads bent close together. There's still a spot of green stuff, blood or brain or something, on his cheek. Rodney can see it from here. While Rodney's watching, John glances over and catches his eye. Rodney touches his own face, mimes rubbing, and after a second, John mirrors him, frowning slightly. He looks at the smear of blood on his thumb, then wipes it on his pants. He doesn't look at Rodney again. The fight is fast and brutal, and Curla wins, Rodney assumes, since he's cleaning his knife on the sleeve of the queen's cousin when Rodney decides it's safe to look up. John and Ronan get taken away to sign something, and Taylor gets into a low conversation with one of the women, and then, with a sinking feeling, Rodney realizes he's been left alone with the queen. She eyes him, and a smile plays around her mouth. Rodney tries not to fidget, and clears his throat, and looks desperately around for John. It is people like you who are destroying this galaxy, the queen says, hardly moving her lips as she surveys the crowd. Rodney jumps. What? You and he, she says, making the slightest nod towards John. His children would be strong. Rodney says, feeling a little numb. He finds himself watching John, who's bending over a long piece of parchment, and he's ambushed by the memory of John talking to Madison once, crouched down in the corridor outside Jeannie's hospital room. As Rodney had watched, she'd reached for John's gun, in easy reach at his hip, and John had gently pulled her hand away. I don't think he wants kids. Which, you know, normally I'd agree with you, but given that I'm far more acquainted with his psychological profile than you are, and not that it's any of your business anyway, but in this case I'm inclined to think it's for the best. And, you know, given that it's worked out pretty well for me, I can't really regret it. The queen doesn't say anything for a while, and Rodney thinks he's escaped. Then she says, "You despise me for killing my husband." What? Rodney says, startled. No, 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 absolutely not. I'm sure it was completely necessary. And, I mean, clearly you're in love with this guy, so I hope you're very happy. The queen keeps her brittle smile and looks out over the room. From amidst the huddle of men in red hats, Curler raises his hand to her in a little wave. A muscle twitches in her jaw, and for a horrible second, Rodney is sure she's going to cry. Oh, God, he's so terrible at this. Something happened to me recently, he blurts out. It's the first thing that comes into his head, and he doesn't know why he's talking about it to this stranger. But now that he is, it feels like it's trying to burst right out of his chest. We had a wraith prisoner, and we needed to keep him alive long enough to... Well, it doesn't really matter. The point is, someone had to die a horrible death to save... someone else. My sister, actually. She has a kid and a husband, and it was this guy Wallace's fault that she was sick. And my fault. But it was mostly his fault. The queen turns to look at him from far, far away. Did he die willingly? Yes, Rodney says, and swallows. After John convinced him. I volunteered, but he wouldn't let me. I would have done it. The queen looks at him, and he can't read her expression. Outside, it's beginning to get light. Men so rarely understand what needs to be done, she says. The flowers are still glowing dimly in the field, a mirror of the dimming stars in the sky above them. The sky is slowly turning pink with the approaching sun. It's pretty, but Rodney can hardly keep his eyes open, he's so tired. The walk to the gate feels like a day and a night. Atlantis, this is Shepard, John says as Rodney dials the DHD, and the gate whooshes into life. Reading you, Colonel Shepard, how did it go? Well, boys and girls, once upon a time there was a queen, and she married a guy who turned into a... Shepard says, and Rodney slaps his own radio. For Christ's sake, Atlantis, let's save the story for the briefing, shall we? I want to go to bed. You're good to go, Dr. McKay. The radio crackles. They walk through the gate. Shepard comes to his door later, when the corridors are quiet and all the sensible people with jobs less important than Rodney's are asleep. What? Rodney snaps. Shepard just looks at him, gaze steady, his hands in his pockets. In the quiet of the city, Rodney can hear both their breathing. Just come in, he says finally, and John does. They sit on the bed together. John's changed his pants, Rodney notices. I want to apologize for earlier, Rodney blurts out finally. His voice sounds brittle. I've got no right to judge. I mean, blew up a cellar system here. It's just, you know, sometimes I wonder how we got here. Yeah, John says. Rodney shuffles sideways and puts his arms around him because he doesn't know what else to do. John sits stiffly for a moment, then shudders a little, and his hands settle on Rodney's back. John exhales. Are you sure it didn't scratch you? Rodney mutters, and he feels John nod. Did you get completely checked? Because it would only take the tiniest scratch. Rodney, John says, and he draws back and pulls up his sleeve. There's a thin red cut on his forearm, fresh and unhealed. I checked, okay? It's fine. It might take a while to enter your bloodstream completely, Rodney says. You should keep checking it and get regular blood tests. John leans close and kisses Rodney. And when he draws back, Rodney sees John has pinched the skin of his arm, squeezed another few drops of blood from the cut. John wipes it off with his finger and licks the red smear away. I'll keep checking, okay? Okay, Rodney says shakily, all the breath going out of him as he reaches for John again. And John is there. You hear the end of that story? He mutters, stroking his thumb along Rodney's jaw until he finds the place he wants, and presses a kiss there. Oh, yes, eventually, Rodney says, distracted. You want to tell me about it? I really, really don't, because strangely, I have better things to do with my time than memorize every pointless local legend I'm exposed to while out saving the galaxy, Rodney snaps. Can we please have sex now? John smiles, hard and sharp. Sure you want to risk it? Oh, for... Rodney cuts himself off, and Rodney grabs John's shoulders, holds him so he has to look, to meet Rodney's eyes. We do what we have to, I get that, Rodney says. We do what has to be done. I'm sure we do. I'm pretty sure. John laughs softly, and it's a bitter sound, but the light's dim with his thought, and when he reaches for Rodney's belt buckle, his hands are steady.